to Agile for All's Humanizing Work Show. I'm Peter Green.
And I'm Richard Lawrence.
A lot of our work is when we're called in to help a team improve. And so this episode is really going to be about what are some things that we've done, some things we've seen, and some stories of teams that we've worked with, and what were the challenges they had, and how did we approach helping those teams overcome those challenges. So Richard, let's start off with you. I'll throw it right your way. Do you have any examples that come to mind for you of teams that you were able to make a difference on? What did you do? What was the challenge? You
know, one of the most common challenges that I run into on teams that I'm coaching is that they're not really a team in the sense of having a compelling shared purpose, a compelling direction. Rather, they're a group of people who do meetings together and have several different goals. And I've seen variations on this. There's an extreme case of one team that I coached where a pair of teams that worked together that I coached where there were, I think, seven different consulting companies represented on those 20 or so people. And there was the official direction for the team, we're building this thing together. There was the true direction for the team was we need to sell more work for my consulting company and squeeze out the other consulting companies in there. And that was one where we couldn't get to an aligned purpose because they were doing politics against each other and really more worried about maximizing for their individual company goal than for the shared goal. But on many of the teams that I've coached where they don't have this shared compelling direction, we can do the work to get the shared compelling direction. It's often a product owner and a scrum team doing the work to identify a vision and communicate that, share about the customer, and build that common understanding of a customer who we're serving and we want to help succeed. And then that group of people who are disparate individuals who are maybe good at separate things become a team. And
well, that example you gave of kind of the one that you couldn't figure out how to fix and improve on, I think there's a pattern there that we see in a lot of teams, which is that people bring their own motivations into a team.
And which is not bad.
That's it's a not a bad thing. It's just a human thing, and we're motivated by different things. And I think when the direction is not compelling enough, that I'm willing to almost subordinate my goal or see how my goal aligns with that, how I can align my personal goal with the overarching goal of the team, then it's really difficult and in some cases impossible for that team to really function like a team as we describe it. I'm reminded of Morningstar, which is a company that is not really based around teams in the sense that we would. The the type of work they do is complicated and obvious if you're familiar with the Ken Evan sense making model.
Tomatoes.
Tomato processing, right? But there is a company mission around generating revenue and around processing tomatoes and quality and those types of things. And individuals in the company write a personal mission statement, but it's my work mission statement. So how is the work that I'm going to do contribute to the overarching goal? And I think that that is an interesting practice for anybody on a team is to say, well, let's get aligned on what the team's mission statement is, purpose, their compelling direction. And then just to have everybody take a few minutes and write down, how do I contribute to that? What is my personal mission in helping the team accomplish that goal? That helps to create some alignment there.
Doesn't automatically do it. Because there's an assumption we're making of transparency and willingness to align. For this particular team I mentioned where I couldn't help them, I actually got fired from that client. That was my first and only experience of that as a coach. I was following the advice I give now, if you can't fix it, make it visible. And I made it visible and the system sort of had an antibody response to that. We don't want this thing that is going to hurt our individual goals.
I think there's an important lesson there though, which is that not every scenario is a scenario that you can improve. And in that situation, often the best thing to do is to remove yourself from the situation. And I would never give advice to somebody because there are all kinds of other factors that come to play there around employment. But if you have the option to say, you know, I could probably find another job somewhere else, sometimes that's a better outcome than sticking with it and trying to make it work and trying to slog through it. So I would always think of, is that an option for me? If you're really in a situation like the one that you describe, or we are not going to be able to get aligned for all these other reasons.
I was young and naive and optimistic and thought I was going to fix it. So it was a bit of a blow at the time. Now, I often can notice those during a sales conversation and disqualify them pretty quickly and work with teams that at least have a chance.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that you and I have in common is that we would much rather disqualify a potential client that we really don't think we're going to be able to make a difference for early on, so that we can focus on the ones where there really is some desire for change and some capability to change there.
Yeah. So that was the challenge of misaligned direction and purpose.
Right.
What's another example of a team challenge you've encountered in your coaching?
One that comes to mind for me is actually a client that we worked with together. Mm-hmm. If you're not familiar with the leadership circle model, we talked about that in the episode on growth in season one. So if you haven't watched that episode, pause now, launch a new browser tab, go search Humanizing Work Show Growth, and watch that episode. You'll get a little bit of insight into what the leadership circle model is. Or you can look up the Leadership Circle's website and become familiar with that model a little bit, because we're going to refer to that now. I'm waiting for you to pause.
We'll wait here.
Launch the new tab. Okay, now that you've watched that, become familiar with the leadership circle.
Right.
There was an interesting dynamic that happened on that team, if you remember. So there were really three members of that team that that we noticed this pattern with. Mm-hmm. And the pattern essentially involved different reactive tendencies, creating this kind of reinforcing feedback loop that was driving them in negative directions. So on this team, we had one member of the team who their predominant tendency was when they were being reactive was to be controlling. And controlling is made up of things like ambition and drive and get it done and push through. Another member of the team whose predominant tendency was around complying, which is I want to take care of people and make sure everybody's happy and make sure I'm doing everything I could be doing. And then a third member of the team who also had a more controlling style when they were in reactive. And the product owner had come to the team and said, look, there are a couple of sprints worth of work that we just got to get this done so that we can move on to some other work that's, that we're pretty excited about. And the symptoms that they were displaying, if we were to take kind of a medical analogy here, some of the symptoms of that were that one team member was really concerned about, I don't know if we're collaborating here, and I don't know if we're honoring our working agreement, and another team member that was saying, just give me the task, I'll knock it out, and then was staying up till all hours of the morning, and she actually got the work done, but it wasn't aligned with that team's working agreement around collaborating and helping each other grow and learn. And so those were kind of the things that they were describing, some of the challenges, and as we looked at it, we realized when the product owner came with a reactive stance of, we just have to do this, this reactive language is reacting to, like, as if we have no choice, versus taking a creative stance, which is, here's an outcome we could create, and wouldn't that be cool? And
how can what's possible here?
Yeah, and how can we collaborate around those things and grow through this this opportunity? What happened is that drove the other people deeper into their reactive tendencies. So you had the one team member saying, just give it to me, I'll get it done, going into her controlling stance. You had another team member saying, am I adding value here? I don't know if I'm helping out enough, and being really concerned that we weren't honoring the working agreement. And so it created this loop that if they hadn't been aware of and broken it, that could have become a spiral, right? Where that became the entrenched behavior on the team. In that case, we were able to, just by making it visible to them, to say, do you notice this language you just used? Of, we have to do it. And then do you notice, we know that the reactive tendencies can go this way for these team members. Do you notice how when we use reactive language, it drives the other team members into their reactive style more strongly than they would have kind of in a normal situation?
Right.
So a lot of interpersonal dynamics and psychology going on there. But again, just making that visible to say, hey, we use reactive language. That drives, it can drive others into their deeper into their reactive tendencies.
Yeah, and so often the fix for these issues is making it visible.
Yeah.
As long as we can assume people want the team to work and want to be successful.
Yeah.
But as long as there is that willingness to make the thing work, a lot of times just making it more visible frees people up to make better choices.
I think that making it visible rarely has a downside, because even in the situation where you're going to make something visible that makes other people highly uncomfortable, that's going to lead to one of two things. Either they're going to act on it and start to improve it, or it's going to become clear that there is not a desire to make that change here. We are not comfortable with that. And if we go back to some of the core research on teams, which we talk about in another episode, there's no psychological safety there if you can't bring up a hard issue. We're not willing to approach conflict in a healthy way if we can't do these things. So all of those things are missing from those teams where it's really not. And just making it visible will let you know, okay, we don't have psychological safety.
Now, I have seen a variation on make it visible that is an example of a destructive challenge that a team faced, which was the person who is so convinced that their perception of the world is right, that they're not interested in hearing from other people or figuring out what's going on. So as they see things, they're like, this is how it is, let me make it visible to you.
Yes.
So rather than making objective things visible that we could agree on, it was, my interpretation is objective and I'm gonna make it visible. And I have seen that actually kill a team where a team member is constantly critical of other people on the team because they believe their perception of everything is right. So it wasn't making things visible in an empathetic, curious way.
It was making the wrong thing visible, probably.
I guess it was making their internal judgments visible, but not as judgments. It was trying to make them visible as if they were fact.
Right, right. And so we often teach the art of focused conversation, right? This pattern of, we should start with objective data before we reflect on it and share our interpretation of it. And whenever we're saying make something visible, what we want to do is make data visible. And even in that...
Which could be objective or reflective.
Yes.
But we're clear about what it is.
It's right. Yeah, this is clear data. Like in the example I gave with that other client, the thing that I made visible to them was, did you notice that you said these words? We've got to do this. And then my reflection on that is, that sounds reactive to me. Does it sound reactive to you? Good, now let's interpret that. Could that have been causing these? So it was actually going through those steps one at a time. And I think that's a key move for a lot of teams, is just being aware that your interpretation of the facts are not the same thing as the facts.
Right.
That's another thing we can make visible, that the way our brains work is we jump right to pattern recognition and interpretation. But there are these other two steps that precede that, and making it visible that those are steps that we should follow and how we communicate and how we share data is pretty important as well.
Right. Yeah. And so I often caution teams not to collect, say, retrospective items that are interpretive during a sprint, thing, like keeping a list of what worked and what didn't.
Yes.
Because that usually isn't objective.
Right.
That's what worked for me based on whatever's going on in me and my perception of what's right and wrong. So collect objective data, reason about it together.
Yeah.
Good. So that's some good, important nuance on make it visible. Because I think somebody, especially with a critical reactive tendency in leadership circle terms, could say, all right, I'm going to make it all visible now. I'm going to tell everybody what's wrong on the team, and that's going to poison a team pretty quickly.
You just reminded me of a personal failure, one of my favorite failures, which is when I was a longtime employee of Adobe, and I had made a diagnosis of what was going on in a specific part of the organization. And the top leader in that organization, I happened to be at dinner with one time, and that leader said, so what do you want to talk about? And I said, I want to talk about the fact that we have a culture of fear. What are you going to do about it? And notice that was me going into my primary reactive tendency, which is critical in the protecting, meaning ego protecting sense. So I went right to my reactive tendency of critical and made an interpretation. A culture of fear is an absolute interpretation with no data to support it, right?
Well, you had some data.
I had some data to support it that other people felt the same way, but I did not start with the facts, with the objective data, or even my reflection on them. Like, here's how I feel when I notice these things happening. I jumped right to interpretation. And
how'd that go?
Well, I will say that it's one of the reasons it's one of my favorite failures is that I actually got a meeting with that leader out of that conversation, but it very quickly petered out. So I did not start with empathy for where they were coming from in that. And the more distance I got from that and the more opportunity I had to reflect on that, I used to think of that as a leadership failure on their part, that they didn't hear me and they didn't address this concern that, you know, admittedly I had generated through lots of retrospectives with many teams. And I used to think, well, that they just failed to address that important thing. As I've reflected on it, I realized, oh, the leadership failure was mine because I went to my reactive, critical tendency there rather than going to something like purposeful and visionary or caring connection. Lots of leadership circle terms in here, folks. If you didn't pause, do it now.
There's another chance.
Another chance. Going to Caring Connection and saying, hey, what do you notice? What do I want to talk about? What do you want to talk about? What challenges are really keeping you up at night? Going to Caring Connection there, going to Purposeful and Visionary, which is, wouldn't it be cool if we could create this outcome? Right. And then seeing what emerged out of that. So it was my
leadership
failure.
Even if you were right, that would have built alignment around it.
Being right doesn't matter.
And if you weren't right, yeah. Being right did not fix that.
Yeah.
Yeah. This reminds me of another issue that I run into on teams frequently, and I've seen varying results overcoming it or not.
Yeah.
And that's the team stance as victim versus actor in their world.
Yeah.
I've encountered teams where all the problems are out there.
You do a retrospective, and the only outcomes are everybody else should change.
Yeah. We're going to have the leaders fix things for us, or that other team needs to stop doing this thing. And with some teams, and quite a few actually, we've been able to reflect on that with the team and use things like Christopher Avery's responsibility process model to get them more self-aware about whether they're taking ownership or seeing the world as acting on them, and they're victims of everything.
Right.
And I have seen many teams make that shift, but it usually requires a collective decision to do it and some shared language so that they can have that self-awareness.
A model I've used when I notice teams struggling with that is we'll place symptoms or undesirable effects or opportunities that in a retrospective format or something like that. We'll place them into three rings of a circle, and in the inside is own. We completely own this challenge. We could solve it on our own. Mm-hmm. The next ring is influence. Maybe we don't fully own it, but we could influence that, right? We could influence a change. And then the third one is still not, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's we can choose how to respond. Mm. And so no matter what, we're at choice and we can get to responsibility. Whether a sticky note, if we were doing this on a whiteboard, a sticky note goes all the way into respond, we can still choose how we want to respond to the context. So all three of those are at choice. When I have people sort those into those, it's very often that more things end up in own than they expected, and more things end up in influence. That's usually the one where it's like, oh, yeah, we actually could influence this change. And very few things go into that outer circle of all we can do is choose how we want to respond to it.
But even that's powerful.
Yes.
You know, it would be silly for me to rail against gravity when I crash my bike.
Right, right.
Like, that's just a thing I'm not going to do anything about, but I can do some work on myself to be able to respond to that better.
That's right, yeah.
So. And that happens in organizations, especially as they get larger. Mm-hmm. There are more things that are just part of the landscape.
That's right.
And you can still choose how you respond to them.
Yeah.
How about more interpersonal things?
Uh-huh. I'll say that another kind of model that I've seen useful to talk about interpersonal things comes from the psychologist John Gottman, who's at the University of Washington. He's kind of famous for being able to, you know, listen in on a like 90 seconds of a conversation between a couple. He does couples research on couples and longevity and different traits in relationships there. And he's been able to very successfully predict whether that couple will stay together over the long term. And he has a book called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, where he describes what he calls four relationship toxins. And what we've done is we've taken that and applied that to teams, because as we talk about in some of the other episodes, the relationships between team members are a core part of whether the team's going to be successful or not. And so we do this exercise we call team toxins, where we put these different stances that people take in stress out on a kind of a grid on the floor, and there are four of them. They're blaming, which is, it's your fault. There's defensiveness, which is, not my fault. There's stonewalling, which is, I don't want to talk about it. And there's contempt, which is,
not even worth talking about
with you. Like, I can't believe you're even bringing this up, right? Mm-hmm. And we do an exercise where people just, we do a little bit of exploration on the floor there, where people will go stand in defensiveness and say, try it on like a jacket. Do I ever get defensive? What can that look like in me? And sometimes they'll try it on and be like, I never go there. And well, all right, at least we tried it on. Then they'll go and stand in each of the other four. And once they've stood in all four of those quadrants of these four different team toxins, we'll ask them to go to their default toxin. What's the one that most of the time they go to? And they'll go stand in, and they'll talk about what do they get out of that, because we don't do those things, you know, consciously.
Right.
but there's some reward there, or there's something driving us taking that stance. And then we'll ask them to say, when the team notices that you're doing that, you might want some help getting out of it. You might not even be aware you're doing it. So how can the team make it visible to you? How can they help you notice it, help you get out of it? And you have the right to pass, right? If you're like, this is feeling a little too risky for me emotionally, I don't want to go there. Mm-hmm. And very rarely does somebody pass, but occasionally they will. And notice what that does. Number one, it normalizes the fact that we're humans. And we have ineffective behaviors that we sometimes lapse into. And so if you think about like Google's research around psychological safety being key for effective teams, mm-hmm. and a lot of the research around teams, that creates psychological safety and vulnerability. Going back to Lencioni's idea of the only thing that creates trust on a team is vulnerability.
Right, that's an admission that you're not a perfect team member.
Exactly right. And a request for help mm-hmm. also creates that vulnerability and starts to build trust.
And builds trust.
Yeah. So that's another fun exercise that we've done with teams, often very successfully. One of our colleagues used this exercise and had a VP participating, and the VP stood in the contempt quadrant. And when they asked, you know, how do you want us to help you with this, the VP said, well, I'd just like you to point it out. I know I can go there sometimes. If you point it out to me, I'm willing to you know, step back. And the very next day, in a conversation, a very junior team member noticed the VP getting into contempt and pointed it out to the VP. And there was like dead silence for a moment to say what's going to happen. It probably felt like a lot longer than it actually was as time dilated. Right?
Yeah.
And the VP said, you're right. I'm sorry, and step back. And
critical moment for that team.
Boom. Like even describing that right now, I don't know if this is picking up on the camera, but I have like giant goosebumps right now thinking about that, because that's such a critical honoring of a commitment to work on myself as well and display vulnerability myself as well, that everything changed in the culture of that team at that moment. And so kudos to that leader for honoring that commitment, right? But that's the type of powerful outcome you can have just by creating some shared vulnerability and some commitments about how we want to behave when we get into our less effective behaviors.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about things that happen with a team,
uh-huh.
and we've talked about things that happen on individual relationships in a team.
Yeah.
I guess the last common team challenge that comes to mind for me is a particular individual on a team, the toxic rock star pattern.
Yeah,
you've seen this in practice in your coaching.
I have, and I've seen it in practice on teams that I've been on. Mm-hmm. I think of a new team that I joined at a company that had a person pretty high up in the organization that was kind of a rock star, and I remember challenging something that person said, and they just completely slapped me down in the meeting. Just, you're wrong, and I knew I wasn't wrong. There was clear data on it. But at that moment, I was shut down. At that point, like if somebody said, hey, do you want to keep working on this team? I'd be like, nope, find me another one. I don't want to work with that person. So there's a lot of research around that. I'm trying to remember which book it was, but they call it the bad apple syndrome, mm-hmm. right? How one bad apple. I remember the research around that was that they had people playing marketing interns, essentially a marketing company. They had a whole bunch of interns. And they wanted to study this a little bit. What is the impact of one bad apple on these teams? And so they were given
introducing them?
Yeah, so they were given these marketing interns like 2 hours to come up with a marketing pitch given, you know, this scenario. And then one of the people, since they were all new, they didn't know each other, one of the people that was in that meeting was an actor. And they were instructed to play the bad apple, and there were a few different flavors of that. There was they called it the Eeyore role. Nothing's ever going to get done here. One of them was the jerk, like, you guys are terrible at this. Just give it to me and I'll do it. And then one of them was somebody that was just completely checked out. Like they were just on the phone the whole time. And what they found is that in almost every single one of those, the team took on the personality of the bad actor without even being aware of it.
So it wasn't just that they struggled to do their thing,
right.
It's that it actually changed the culture.
It changed the culture of the team, and they all kind of regressed to that style. But when you asked them at the end, how did the project go? They said, it went pretty well. But they were like cameras, and they were studying these things and studying interactions. And they noticed that all of the teams took it on, but they weren't even aware that they had taken on that personality. That was the case in all but one. There was one team where there was just some kid who, you know, was a marketing intern like everybody else. When the bad actor, literally a good actor playing a bad role. And I think he was trying to play the jerk role in that particular team. Mm-hmm. This kid would just say, huh, that's an interesting perspective. What do others think? And the actor, when he was debriefed at the end of that, said, so what was that like for you when this kid kept doing that? And he's like, it was so hard for me to stay in that role. And he really struggled. And so it is possible that if you have somebody that is a real skilled, very present facilitator, that you can counteract some of that behavior. But that's almost going to be a full-time job if you have somebody who is constantly going in it, and they're just driven by something besides the team's success. They're driven by ego, or they're driven by other motivations. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a real challenge, and it's going to be a full-time job for somebody. And most of the research shows that you're better off removing that person from the team.
Mm-hmm. Practical advice for our audience.
Well, we've covered a few different kind of categories here, right? So some of the advice are some of these models we've used to help strengthen relationships and display vulnerability and become more self-aware. And so a team is a group of individuals collaborating. The more aware the individuals are, the better off the team is going to be. And a lot of teams will make that just like they have a compelling direction as far as value they're trying to create or an outcome they're trying to create. They put individual and team development and growth as right along with that, right? Robert Keegan describes that in his book, In Everyone Culture, where he talks about what he calls deliberately developmental organizations, where those two things are intertwined, where we get better business outcomes when people are growing, and when the business outcomes are good, then that helps people grow, and it, kind of, you almost envision a double helix, right, of two
virtuous
streams
cycles
of work, right, helping each other out. And so that would be one bit of advice is to think about how am I growing individually and then how am I helping my teammates grow individually.
I like that doesn't require you to be a leader who changes things.
Right.
I'm going to change things from wherever I am and make things better. Now, if you are in a leadership role, you may be able to do some things to improve the system to make it healthier.
That's right. Yeah. And I think even in a leadership role, introducing some of these ideas and models, leadership circle or team toxins or some of these tools can be really powerful. And then the other one that we mention a lot is making things visible and starting with data and reflections and clarifying this is data that I see, this is my reflection on the data before we jump to interpretation as a way to solve hard problems. So we make them more visible. So do these models always work in your experience, Richard?
No.
Good.
Yeah.
It's not just me then.
These are things that can help, but so much of it depends on everyone being willing to do the work of self-awareness and improvement and things in the context to work. And there's so many variables.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the right move is to recognize that a team has reached the end of its life. Yeah. And it's okay to appreciate it for what it's done. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about the life-changing magic of tidying up and the thanking your socks that I refer to a lot of times, which is in Marie Kondo's book, she talks about appreciating things you need to get rid of for what they've done to kind of get rid of the attachment to them, our tendency to overvalue what might be and get honest about what will actually do. So, and the way to do that is to look back. And so a good way for a team to end would be to appreciate what did we accomplish as a team, and what we might have accomplished is that we've learned that this can't be a team. And that's the big takeaway, is that there were certain things about this team that we're not going to do again.
Right.
And that's okay. So it's appreciating it, you know, thanking the past in a way, explicitly or implicitly, and moving on.
Yeah, and I think that I've been in scenarios where there was not a compelling reason to break a team up. But you know, a lot of organizations, the way that they do structures and resource management, as they often refer to it, is, you know, a team has a lifespan, and then a new project comes along. We break that team up, and we put people on new projects, which is, you know, something that we coach leaders about the impacts of. And so I think a lot of people watching this have probably been on teams that they finally got it working, and then the project ended, and they all disbanded. And I think that advice that you just shared is really powerful as well for those teams, where there wasn't a great reason to disband that team. The organization may have been better off keeping the team together and funneling it different type of work to them.
But maybe that's out in the response circle.
But that's in the response circle, and we can respond to that by really mindfully appreciating what happened here mm-hmm. and still celebrating it. And I've been on teams like that where we're still good friends years later. Mm-hmm. And you know, having that emotional bond that's created by collaborating and helping each other out towards creating some outcome in the world mm-hmm. can be really powerful. And celebrating that, even in those scenarios, can be pretty valuable.
Great. As always, we want to hear from you. Share in the comments some of the challenges that you've faced on Teams and challenges that you've overcome and how you overcame them on Teams. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.